I want to apologize, first of all, if you've heard what I'm going to speak about this morning before. Sometimes we do need to hear things the second time, don't we, before it kind of sinks in? I've got a library of books at home, and somebody once said to me, "Have you read all those books in your library?" And I said, "Well, some of them I've read twice." So if you remember what I've spoken about before on this subject, that's good. And hopefully it will help you remember it even more. I was thinking about this morning when I became aware that the pastor was not going to be able to be here. I thought, oh my, what am I going to speak on? What should I talk about? And I had studied the Sabbath school lesson. I was going to teach the class, and August graciously filled in for me. So I thought, you know, my thoughts and my mind were thinking about the Sabbath. I think I'm going to continue on that vein. So I've entitled this subject, or this message this morning, "The Forgotten Signature." A number of years ago, and I go way back, at least 25 years ago, I became interested for a while in collecting some paintings. Now, don't think I invested a lot of money in these because I didn't have any. I was a student at the time. But there was an individual that came by with paintings, and they were actually oil paintings, and to my mind, they were good. I mean, I basically stickman 101 if I tried to paint something, but they were good paintings, but by basically starving artists, you know, people that you really didn't know, and so on and so forth. And I was able to purchase several of them. I still have one left. It's been in my office for, almost 30 years now, I think. It's a beautiful picture. And I purchased it at this painting party that they had where people were invited, and then all these different paintings were shown, and you could purchase one. And, you know, they were, I don't remember, maybe $50, $25 or something like that. For a student's budget, though, they were about all I could afford. The one that I kept and still have is a scene of a little rustic cabin. It's in the woods by a lake, and its colors show the time of the day to be sundown. It's just beautiful orange, pink hues kind of blended together as the sun is setting over this little cabin on this lake surrounded by the woods. You can kind of imagine it. I can see it very clearly in my mind right now. I don't know who the artist was, or whether or not they ever became famous or not. Probably not. But I thought about that as I was thinking about this message, and I thought about the importance that artists place or do not place upon their works of art. I read this. A young semi-accomplished artist named Mike Barr wrote these words. He said, "I don't know about you, but I've often looked at a painting and wondered who the artist was. I wished to know, but the signature in the bottom corner just didn't tell me. Unless we want to remain anonymous, a legible signature is worth its weight in gold." Now, he was referring to paintings where he'd look in the bottom corner to find it, and it would just be a scribble like this, and he had no idea what the word was, what the name was. So he was making the argument that if you're an artist, you need to write your name in that corner in a very legible way that people will know that's you. He says, "Unless we want to remain anonymous, a legible signature is worth its weight in gold. And this is why. You never know where your paintings are going to be seen and admired. And someone may just want some of your work after seeing an example of it. A signature that is readable is the first step in someone following you up and finding you." Now, he was from England, and so he goes on to say, "For example, the Lord Mayor of Adelaide," whoever that was, "bought one of my works last year at a solo show at Greenhill Galleries, and it now hangs on one of his walls." The mayor. "In a way," he said, "it's a permanent exhibition of my work, even if it's only one painting. So a visitor of the Lord Mayor has seen the work, he noted my name, and in this wonderful world of the World Wide Web, they've gone home and they Googled me." Just by seeing my name there in the corner of that picture. artists' signatures are as individual and unique, I find, as the artists themselves. Vincent van Gogh never used anything more on his paintings than Vincent. Norman Rockwell, early in his career, simply signed N.R. and then later changed it to Norman Rockwell. Monet, that famous French painter, simply signed it Claude Monet. Michelangelo, it is said, only signed one work in his entire life, and it was a sculpture. Stuart Davis signed his graphic-laden works with his full name, large enough that said to read at 20 paces away. He wanted to be known, apparently. Just recently, it was discovered that Leonardo da Vinci put his initials, L.P., almost microscopically into the eyeball of the Mona Lisa. Did you know that? That's how you can find out whether it's authentic or not. Picasso, another famous painter, totally seemingly indifferent to his signature. Only occasionally did he sign his work. And by the way, this has created an opportunity, so thought, for forgers to come along and pass off a counterfeit painting as being the original Picasso's. But not knowing that he rarely signed his work, when they signed it in the bottom, it immediately gave him away. So, why am I talking about paintings and signatures this morning and art? I obviously have something else in mind. But I agree with the words of an art critic whose name was Marion Evans, who said this: adding your signature to a painting is like adding a stamp to it that reads finished. It is a sign that you're satisfied with the painting and no longer consider it a work in progress. Unquote. That's what she said. You see where I'm going. Genesis 1:31 tells us, God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Genesis depicts, if you're willing to look at it that way, it depicts God as the master artist at work, creating the world and all that is in it in 6 days. What tools did he use? His creative mind, the power of his word, his own breath, and a handful or two of mud and clay. Nothing to draw upon, no pattern to copy. Instead of brilliantly picking and choosing colors and shades of light, he created light. He invented color. Instead of making things look as if they were alive, he animated his creation with the vital, mysterious force of life itself. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And even God had to say, I wouldn't change a thing. It is just as I want it to be. I'd like you to think this morning of God as the artist, the master artist. Creativity itself. And draw upon that as we consider for a moment the beauty, the sheer unimaginable beauty of God's creative power and God's creation as we know it at the earth. But after having done this, after having said it was very good, it's finished, so to speak, like all great artists, he wanted to make sure that we saw who made it. He wanted to make sure that the signature was put down. And so we further read in Genesis 2, verses 1 through 3, thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing, and so on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. I go back to Marion Evans' statement one more time. Adding your signature to a painting is like adding a stamp to it that reads finished. It's a sign that you're satisfied with the painting and no longer consider it a work in progress. You've put your signature on it. I want to press the point home this morning that the seventh day Sabbath that we enjoy here today and that we worship on once a week and that we celebrate together, I want to press that point home that the seventh day Sabbath is God's signature as creator of this world and everything in it. He signed it when the work was done. I like that word sign because it reminds us of another text. Although I doubt whether Marion Evans knew it, but it was so appropriate for her to say that it is a sign that you're satisfied with the painting. For in Exodus 31:7, speaking of the Sabbath, God says, it will be a what? A sign. Sign between me and the Israelites forever. Now that word sign comes from that word signature or vice versa. Same root word. It will be a sign between me and the Israelites forever. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day he abstained from work and rested. Yes, like a great painting, the signature identifies the author, and it is his sign to those who admire the painting, and by admiring it and noting the signature, we acknowledge whose work we are adoring. But sadly, we live in a world today that by and large has forgotten whose signature is on the painting. Emily said to me as we finished the story this morning, when instead of saying the Sabbath, she was thinking, first of all, saying, what is the Earth's birthday? She was going to say Earth Day. Whenever that is. That's something that those who don't quite know whose signature is on the bottom of that painting, they've made it up. We have people who have forgotten whose signature is on the painting. Worse still, we have a large segment of the population today that maintain that there is no signature on the painting. It just happened, they say. Over billions of years and countless billions of random actions and mutations and reactions. There's no artist, they say. There's no creative designer who's responsible for all of this. But saying that there is no signature on the painting, no creator of this awesome work called life with its unfathomable complexity and harmony and beauty does not mean that it is true. It is the signature, the Sabbath, we are told, which could have kept the world from drifting. In the book Patriarchs and Prophets, page 336, it says, had the Sabbath always been sacredly observed, there could never have been an atheist or an idolater. Perhaps that's why the commandment that was read by Jacqueline this morning begins with the word remember. Think of it. A world without heathenism, without idolatry, without atheism, a world without any dark Africas or superstitious Easts, instead of over 2 billion inhabitants of Earth being without the gospel, God could have been, would have been acknowledged from sunset to sunset. You see, this sheds new light on the passage in Romans 1. Verses 18 through 20, where the Apostle Paul says, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and the wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. Man in his right mind, looking at the creation around him, looking at this world, looking at pondering the meaning of life and the origin of all things, I say in his right mind, must come to the conclusion that this reality has a designer, a creator, a mind, intelligence itself. But stubbornly he has refused to acknowledge this. Romans goes on to say, instead he began to worship the creature instead of the creator. And we find ourselves in a world today where almost beyond belief there are those who maintain rigidly this idea that there is no signature on the painting. Doesn't need one. Although it's quite interesting, just as a small little aside, in the scientific world today, as we begin to learn more and more and more about our universe through technology, through scientific discovery, you won't hear this, you won't read it so much in the tabloids, but there is a growing number of scientists today that are at least coming to the conclusion that there must have been something, someone who started this. The evidence is pointing in that direction more and more and more. So it's Romans 1, perhaps in reverse, as we begin to honestly look at the data around us. We recognize God has revealed himself. He's made it plain so that if we come to the conclusion that there's no signature on the painting, we are without excuse. Hans Walter Wolff said that whenever man is unable to see God's creation, his existence inevitably becomes devoid of meaning. When we lose God, we lose ourselves. What is almost humorous today, when you think about it, is the sense of enjoyment that people who do not believe in God's existence, by the way, still have of his great work. The naturalist today finds a sense of awe as he or she looks out upon the world. They love to study nature. They revere nature. And yet they will not acknowledge the one who made it. They acknowledge that it is a very good painting indeed, and they spend much time observing it and enjoying it. It must be preserved, they say, at all costs, and must be taken care of. And I don't want to ridicule them, but I wonder how much more their enjoyment would be if they would only believe that all that they now revere and almost worship today is the product of the eternal, self-existent Creator. Why do you want to reject that hypothesis? Why do you want to reject that fact, that idea that there's a Creator behind all this? By forgetting the Sabbath, man has forgotten God. By forgetting God, man has forgotten the Sabbath. And I wonder which one came first. Little wonder that right in the heart of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, which clearly have a universal application, the fourth commandment begins with the word remember. How tragic that the one commandment that God specifically asked man to remember, he has forgotten most of all. Most people remember the other nine, don't they? but the fourth is forgotten. Years ago, when mules were used in the mines of Pennsylvania, a gentleman passing by noticed the animals in the field nearby and inquired the reason. These mules are worked in the mines through the week, and they are brought up into the light on the Sabbath to keep them from going blind. The application is apparent, isn't it? The stubborn addiction of man to earthly things and the neglect of the Sabbath requirement which God placed in the bosom of his law have led to spiritual blindness, spiritual sorrow, overworked, exhausted, with little clue as to what life is all about. We need the Sabbath today, don't we? The world needs the Sabbath today more than it ever has. Even though, scientifically speaking, the world isn't spinning any faster than it always has, it seems that way, doesn't it? Spinning around, more activities, more deadlines, more requirements, more responsibilities. We need the Sabbath today more than ever because it is God's gift to us. And it answers the three most important questions of life. One, from what source do we come? Two, toward what goal do we rightfully move? And three, why does it make a difference? You could preach a series of a dozen sermons on the Sabbath and still not exhaust all the meaning of this great gift. And I would like to highlight the idea that it is gift we're talking about. As Seventh-day Adventists, we oftentimes look, and there is a place for it, I should say, we look at the Sabbath as test. It's going to be the test at the end of time. We have a theology that's built on that. But in overemphasizing test, I wonder sometimes if we've forgotten the original intention of the Sabbath, and that was gift. The Sabbath is a gift before it's a test. The Sabbath is something we need, and God knew that we needed it, and so he gave it to us. He blessed it. He set it apart. He made it holy. And that blessing is experienced by all who will observe it. It is a gift. As a boy, I grew up, and I'll be honest with you, the Sabbath, oh, what time is the sunset today, Mom? What time is the sunset, Dad? My idea was about all the things I couldn't do on the Sabbath. I was a boy. I was active. I had interests, you know. And the Sabbath sometimes seemed long to me. But I've changed my thinking. I've changed my thinking, and I can honestly tell you right now, the Sabbath is the joy of the week. It is the day I look forward to. Not because of all the things I can't do, but because of the things that now I can do. I wish that we could change the way we think about that, particularly young people. Think about the Sabbath not so much as the things I can't do, but what can I do on the Sabbath that I'm really not really able to do the rest of the week? That's what the Sabbath means. That's why it's a gift. There are things in this that the Sabbath offers to you that no other day offers. A 24-hour oasis away from the world's demands and its incessant pressure. God gives us a break from all that. Free to fellowship, free to worship, free to spend time outside in nature. When do you really get to do that during the week? Free to take a nap. When do you get to do that during the week? I'm not suggesting that's how we should spend our whole Sabbath, but the Sabbath is gift, and I'm talking about the elementary part of it. Ultimately, the gift of the Sabbath is the fellowship with Him, a day to know and refresh ourselves, to remind ourselves who we are, why we're here, where we're going, and why does it make a difference. And that's how we should think of the Sabbath, particularly among those, even those who believe, who will suggest to us, does it really matter which day? After all, one day is as good as another. Without wanting to step on anybody's toes, I observe and I look around at our Christian brothers and sisters, good Christian people who love the Lord, who may worship on another day of the week. But I observe sometimes and I don't see that sense of rest that the Sabbath in its originality was intended to give and bring. Too often it's been, the holy day has been transformed into the holy hour from 11 to 12. The world needs the theology of the Sabbath. When you let the Sabbath go and claim, well, it's the Lord's day now. It's been moved to the Lord's Day in honor of the resurrection. When you let that go, you cannot let the theology of the Sabbath go without losing something precious that is found in the heart of it, that is as true today as it was when God created the world. Sabbath keepers are often accused of being into works. We're free from that. Being under the law of works because they insist in remembering God's Sabbath. It is said that the Sabbath is part of the old covenant of works, which was meant for the Jews, not Christians. Well, I won't take a lot of time, but the origin of the Sabbath, that beautiful, beautiful day, that blessed day, the origin of the Sabbath predates the Jewish nation by thousands of years. One. The other mention of the Sabbath in Deuteronomy, where the Sabbath commandment is tied to God's delivering the Israelites from Egypt. And oftentimes that text is used to say, well, see, it's just for the Jews. But that reason for the Sabbath is just as important as the creation reason, because the deliverance from Egypt that the Israelites experienced was a type of salvation, was it not? And we today, even the Christian church, even those who don't worship the Sabbath, take elements from that deliverance experience and we observe it. Easter, the Passover. We take that. Why can't we not take the Sabbath along with it? Which was also a sign, as Moses said, a sign that we were to observe the Sabbath because God had delivered his children of Israel from Egypt. The next time you hear the idea that the Sabbath was for the Jews or you're into works or whatever, shock them. Tell them they're right. The Sabbath is all about works. And that every Sabbath you celebrate works. But then quickly remind them that it is God's works, not yours. When we observe the Sabbath, we are remembering that God's works are perfect and complete. That's what it was all about, wasn't it? God had finished the work of creation. Therefore, he set aside the seventh day and blessed it. Our Sabbath rest today is based on the fact that in salvation terms, God has finished the work of salvation. We're accepted because of his works. They're perfect. They're complete. Two times God said it is finished. In Genesis, when he created the world and he made the Sabbath. And when our Lord Jesus died upon the cross and secured our salvation for eternity, he said, it is finished. And then the Sabbath followed the next day. Just as Adam and Eve on the first Sabbath couldn't add a single thing to what God had done for the previous 6 days, they couldn't contribute. They were to enjoy. The Sabbath was for enjoying what God had made. Adam and Eve couldn't contribute anything. So we today cannot add a single morsel to the perfect and completed work of God in creation and redemption. Amen? That is why the Bible connects rest with the Sabbath. Rest in terms of creation and rest in terms also of salvation. That's why Hebrews says there is still a Sabbath rest for the people of God. We rest as if all our work is completed as well. It is this rest which the world desperately needs but can't find because they won't acknowledge the signature. They need to know who they belong to and that they were created to have a personal relationship with Him. That's what the Sabbath was made for. It is as though God had said to Adam after his creation on the sixth day, Adam, Eve, behold this wonderful world, full of objects, animate and inanimate, which call for admiration. I made them for you. But beware, none of them, nor all of them, can satisfy you. Not even Eve can do that for you, and Eve, not even Adam can do that for you. You were made for me. Your heart can find rest only in me. Sabbath rest. I am its source. Therefore, let's spend your whole first day together as a pattern for your life from here on. The first Sabbath was God's acted out invitation to all men to find their rest in Him. How can we throw that away without throwing away the meaning as well? Imagine looking at the most priceless work of art in existence and not being able to recognize it as such because you don't know who painted it. What a loss. What a tragedy. How our world suffers for lack of knowledge. Without the Sabbath, we're reduced to being nothing but consumers and producers, exhausting ourselves in the treadmill of life with no rest, no peace. The story is told of a busy editorial writer who had to spend large amounts of time reading type on a page. Her eyes began to trouble her, and she was obliged to visit a specialist. She told him she thought she needed a new pair of glasses, but the specialist replied that her real need was not new spectacles, but rest for her eyes. The woman responded that such was impossible, for her work compelled her to sit all day bending over a desk, reading and writing, working on a computer. Upon inquiring where she lived and finding out that it was in full sight of the Blue Ridge Mountains in the Alleghenies, the specialist advised her, "I want you to go home. I want you to do your work as usual. But every hour or so, leave your desk, go out and stand on your porch, and just look at those mountains. The far away look will rest your eyes after the long strain of reading manuscripts and proof sheets." Brothers and sisters, that's exactly what the Sabbath was made for. That far away look that brings rest and sustenance and inspires our souls.